You're listening to 42 Macros Pro to Pro Live, hosted by Darius Dale.
Howdy, Team 42. It's your skipper here, Darius Dale, to present another exciting episode of Pro to Pro Live. I'm joined with our friend, Michael Levy from Rabobank. How you doing today, Michael?
I'm good, thank you.
It's good. I see you're in a hotel, man. Where are you off to?
I'm in freezing cold London today for my sins.
Nice. And then you said, you said you're kind of based out of London in Thailand. That sounds exciting.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of traveling involved in what I do. And yeah, currently over here in the colder part of the world.
Love that. Well, enjoy your trip, man. So tell us a little bit about yourself and what you guys do for your clients at Rabobank, so we get a little bit of a background.
Sure. Let's start with Rabobank. So we're obviously a huge retail bank in the Netherlands. We're also the world's leading food and agri-bank internationally. So we bank everything to do with the food and commodity cycle from farm to fork. And we have a fantastic research network within that space, within which I sit as global strategist. So I don't look at any of the food network per se, although I interact with those guys regularly. I'm cross-asset and cross-disciplinary and cross-geography, trying to look at the big picture view, which I use a lot of heterodox thinking and economic history to put together, to try and explain where I think we're going to tie together macro markets, and as I said, that food system, and put it all together. So it's not a conventional role. It's not a money management role. It's much more looking at risk mitigation rather than, you know, digging out profit opportunities per se. But I think it gives a very unique perspective. But then we are a very unique bank.
Yeah, no, I've seen your work. It's outstanding. If folks haven't checked you out, definitely go check you out. I'll give you an opportunity at the end to point people in your direction. So I'll start by saying, when you say you're not in a, because I've seen your work and you know, I've seen some of the calls you made over the course of my career in the currency market in particular, and they've been spectacular. When you say risk mitigation, talk to us about how you work with your clients in terms of mitigating risk and how you pull all these different pieces of the puzzle together for them.
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously, from the corporate side, if you've got a significant FX exposure, which many of the big players do, and you've got a large import bill, you know, in another currency, if you get a 10-15% swing in the FX rate, which can easily happen with some of the currencies that the large commodity importing or exporting countries have, that's it. That's your profit for the year and more gone. So no matter how well you've run your business, you've lost it all on the FX side, or of course, for every business, on the rate side. So from the CFO perspective, you're constantly looking at managing that interest rate risk, which effectively puts you in traditional rate strategist mode to try and look at. And equally, you're looking at the FX risk. So therefore, you've got an FX strategy hat that you have to wear too within that. But then nowadays, and where I spent most of my time, as I'm sure you're aware, for the past couple of years in this global strategy role, is looking at geopolitical risk. And how all of them are now intersecting or conflating as one. And so more and more of my conversations with clients and key stakeholders are literally about what the hell is going on around us. Is it just chaos and noise and, you know, there's an orange man in the White House? Or is there actually something more intelligent that you can say about it? And can we try and plot a picture of what it looks like now and what it might look like going forward? And so that's a hell of a lot of my time doing that.
Well, let's just hop right into it. Is it all chaos and noise, or is there a grand strategy here that you're guiding your clients towards?
Well, look, opinions vary. Okay, so I'm giving you my opinion, and I fully recognize that a market is a buyer and a seller, right? So, I believe there is. I don't believe it's, you know, 360 degrees. I don't think it's perfect. I don't believe it hasn't got flaws. What doesn't? Everything does. But I don't believe it's just random. I don't believe it's just purely the art of the deal, although the art of the deal definitely has, you know, a strong showing within it. But I believe there is a what I call a grand macro strategy. So you've got your traditional grand strategy that countries used to have. Where do we sit on the map? How are we looking vis-a-vis other states around us? A kind of game of risk for real. And that's being filtered through markets and traditional macro analysis. So I call it grand macro strategy. And I do believe the US has one. But I think what we are seeing is that when you try and implement it, other people can push back. This is a two-way process. There are a lot of players playing this game. And guess what? They're just as competitive as the US, if not more. So sometimes you have to pivot tactically. You know where you want to get to. you start by veering right and suddenly this isn't working. Right, let's go all the way left and see if we can get to the same place. Any good coach in a game of football would be doing that, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so where do you think, and I agree, I do think they have a grand strategy, and I'll talk about sort of where I think we're headed after you, but what do you think this is all, in an ideal world, what does the world look like according to the Trump administration at the end of all this?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I actually published a paper on that earlier this week as we're speaking. And let me just divert to talk about that just for a moment, if I may.
Yeah, sure.
You have to identify the ideology of the individual. And again, it's easy to just say art of the deal, Trump's transaction. That doesn't really tell you a lot. What he clearly is, and I've been saying this for the longest time, is he's a neo-mercantilist, meaning he wants to run as strong a trade position as he can do. He wants to increase physical production of goods in the US as much as possible. He wants to be as high up the value chain as possible everywhere he can. He wants everyone doing productive things as much as possible, and he wants great physical strength in the US. So this is a traditional viewpoint of the world that, you know, was how we did things for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And he's definitely a throwback to that. But there are different schools of thought within it. So if you look at even US history, for example, you've had neo-mercantilists in your past. In fact, you had them for most of the time up until post-World War II. Alexander Hamilton, for example, was a neo-mercantilist. Absolutely, he was. With his report on manufacturers talking about tariffs. So was McKinley, who Trump keeps talking about all the time. But you had some people who said, what we want to get to is free and fair trade. So we're going to use tariffs. We're going to use subsidies. We're going to use, you know, other implements of statecraft to try and get to a position whereby we can level that playing field. And then we go back to real free and fair trade. And other people have said, no, we want to use these tools just to dominate others. We want to make sure that we just absolutely win and win and win and keep winning. And so from a Trump perspective, you can say he's doing all this to try and make trade deals with everybody. He's going to crack the whip, and we will actually end up with more free trade and fewer trade barriers between countries going forwards. And I think there's a lot of validity to that. But there is also this, you know, gut instinct that he has, I think, to try and press that advantage where he can also, and to say, you know, and I want to be running a surplus if I can do, rather than running a deficit. And if we go that route, we get a very, very different set of policies that all need to be used. So either way, it's going to be volatile, but it's, again, key to understand this ideology to get what the end game will be.
Yeah, 100%. And do you, in your sense of, you know, we're all reading tea leaves here and trying to piece together the puzzle, but in your sense and according to your analysis, do you think he is going to be successful in this transition? And what levers can he pull from here to kind of facilitate success, if at all?
Okay, great question. Let's break it into two parts. So the first one, I think he's got a better chance than people give him, particularly like in the traditional financial media. They hate everything to do with neo-mercantilism, even though many of the countries they describe on a day-to-day basis, like Germany, like Japan, like South Korea, like China, are totally neo-mercantilists. They just won't call them that. But when Trump does it, it is, because they're this, you know, the US is the centerpiece of the entire global system. So you start playing with that and everything starts changing. So they tend to write off what he's doing and just say it's madness, it can't work. I think he's got a better chance than people realize, but it's nonetheless not that easy to do. It's, to use an analogy I was using earlier today, it's like trying to pimp your ride while you're riding it. Like you're doing 90 miles an hour down the road on a potholed road and you're pimping it at the same time. You know, it's an interesting experiment, right? So that's important. But I think what's just as important, and this comes back to this risk mitigation I'm talking about, you need to have a logical grid in your head. If he succeeds, what are we going to start to see emerging? What do you buy? What do you sell? What are you short? What are you long? What are you worried about if he wins?
Mm-hmm.
And what if he fails? Because, you know, either outcome, you bet on your team before a big match. You want them to win. Doesn't mean they're going to. You know, what kind of emotional or physical hedges do you put in place just in case it doesn't happen? And it's very important for all people to consider all possibilities when you've got something this big and this difficult to do.
Oh, 100% agree with you. I'll go to our first chart here. Yeah, I've been of the view that, I think you probably agree, that Trump himself was elected as a function of the demand for populism in the United States. You know, he's almost sort of, he's both a arbiter of the populism, but he's also a result of the populism, you know,
correct,
in my opinion. And so part of the I think you can maybe disagree or not, but from my perspective, part of the desire for neo-mercantilism is a desire to create an economy that is more egalitarian, that shares the wealth, more evenly distributes the wealth. This chart here shows labor share of national income down at the down and to the right for decades, now at 51.5% of gross domestic income and falling again. And then we have corporate profits. So we use that as a proxy for capital share of national income up and to the right. You know, we've had this massive divergence from how these ratios have trended over time, really ever since, you know, you kind of got into peak globalization back in the 90s, early 2000s. Obviously, we had NAFTA in the 90s. China joined the WTO and getting most favored nation status in the early 2000s. Fun fact, one of the most salient memories of my life were the WTO riots back in 2000 or 2001 in Seattle. And obviously, I was too young. I might have been 12 years old or 13 years old at the time, thinking like, wow, these people are going nuts over trade. Like, fast forward to today, 25 years later, it's like, oh, no, wait, I see why they went nuts over trade. And so very clearly, this is not just a Donald Trump issue. This is a U.S. voting person issue. And so, Mike, I guess my question to you is this sort of based on his neo-mercantilism, do you think if he's going to be successful, do you expect to see a significant narrowing of this sort of, you know, what I would consider to be a toxic imbalance?
Again, great question. I agree with everything you said. I look at some of these charts directly myself too. Again, there are two routes you can go, because if you look at past neo-mercantilists, and you know, at the end, I'll share this paper that I put out. It's available for people to read. Thanks. Some of them in the past, not just in the US, but in other countries who have had similar thoughts for similar reasons, they would argue that the metric of success is you've got to get that blue line back up. You have to get the labor share up. And I do believe if you look at the rhetoric from MAGA, much as people dismiss it, because they can't believe this is a Republican Party saying it. And I get that completely. Well, you know, they don't really mean it. Okay, we can have that debate. But a lot of them say they do. But you do have another school, again, within this neo-mercantilism umbrella, who say, not the focus. The focus is national power. We don't mind if that blue line stays low, provided we have basically just got enough stuff being made in the US that we have a large enough military that we can just set terms to the rest of the world in a very, very crude form. Yeah. I don't know which one will emerge. I know which one would be more popular with which demographic and, you know, and with which particular interest group. I think we can all understand that. Wall Street, for example, which is already horrified at MAGA and at neo-mercantilism. And I mean, they're disgusted by it. Oh, yeah. They will be triply, quadruply disgusted at the prospect that it's happening in order to push up wages for blue collar workers and coincidentally push them down for white collar workers. And I don't mean middle level white collar workers. I mean the top 1%.
Totally.
Because that's the corollary. If it's going to happen, he who is first will be last, to use a biblical phrase. So can you imagine what the Wall Street Journal headlines and op-eds are going to be like if we start getting that? But it could be. And we have to keep tracking these metrics. How many times the Treasury Secretary says we're focusing on Main Street, not Wall Street. How many policies are put in place to try and enact that? And in fact, can I add just one more quick point on that before we move on?
Yeah, take your time. Yeah, no, this is fascinating.
Okay. If you look at all the different sectors in the US economy, when Trump was first elected, I was on another excellent podcast, and we were just discussing the implications of what I thought would happen based on what we are discussing now. And I said, your initial gut level reaction is going to be Trump is going to do ABC. He's going to like defense. He's going to like X. He's going to like Y. Buy those shares. And I said, once you start thinking like a neo-mercantilist, that's actually not what happens. So say, for example, US defense. The gut level reaction would be Trump wins, go long defense stocks. If you look at how the defense industry in the US is structured, and I'm not making any recommendations, I'm just talking, you know, as a foreigner, helicopter view, but who's looked at it for many, many years, the US defense sector is highly concentrated. We all know that. There are only a few big firms now. If you read national security papers, they complain about it just as much as economists do. Oh, yeah. And as a result, they can take a $2 widget and sell it for $100.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a fantastic profit margin to be made in that. Okay. So if you're purely thinking of it in what I call because markets terms, you're like, hey, let's have more of that. If you're thinking of it now as the president saying, we need some national power here, you're going to say, well, you're selling me a $100 widget and it should be two. How about you sell it to me for 10 and say thank you very much that you still get to sell it to me for 10?
Yeah.
And that margin gets compressed. Now, we're seeing that in the energy sector. We're seeing it in defense. You've just seen him announce it on pharma, of course. You know, and so you could start drawing up a list of what needs to be squeezed to get that blue line to go up without necessarily raising nominal wages, just in terms of bringing down costs. And I think one of the other ways to look at it is if you look at the, I don't know if you have the chart in your pack, where you have the accumulative change in the CPI basket by different goods, whether it's health, education.
Yes.
Television sets. I'd be wondering. Oh, fantastic. Okay.
We have it by broken down by different categories.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So if you look at that going back X number of years, I'll let you flick through.
I'll land on the right chart as you.
Okay, sure. You'll see that obviously some of them go up very, very sharply, and we know which ones do. Mm. And some of them go down very sharply. And the ones that go down tend to be cheap stuff made in China.
Yep.
Right? And the ones that go up are anything services based in the US.
Correct.
So part of this neo-mercantilist trend now is going to be those lines going down, the cheap stuff from China, that can't keep going down. That has to at least level off. And it's probably going to have to go up a bit because we're going to make more of that back in the US. So at the very least, it's not going to be a deflationary force. Ergo, if you're not going to have inflation getting out of control, and that's an if, you're going to have to compress the inflation you're seeing in all those other areas, which are, again, quite concentrated. And they've been making really nice money for a long period of time. So if you get the ideology right, and this is where I start, I understand what the person's thinking. And you look at the history of who's thought like this before. So I've got a case study to compare it with. Then you can start saying, well, if he thinks like this person, wow, we're going to see a compression there where goods prices go up a bit, but those services prices, pharma, come down, an awful lot. Again, doesn't mean it will happen. Doesn't mean it will succeed. It's not a forecast. It's a logical framework for how to see things.
Thank you for sharing this, Michael. Oh my God, I wish I talked to you 2 hours ago. I just published our morning note, and I was going through all the April data that we received to date out of the U.S. economy to kind of gauge, okay, how does the economy look at the very early start of this kind of tariff spat? And it was unusual to me in the sense, in fact, I have the data. In fact, it was very unusual to me to see the economy demonstrate such resilience. I'm just using the data that was reported, but retail sales, auto sales, obviously there's some tariff front running there. We have well above trend of industrial production capacity utilization. That rhymes with 9 consecutive quarters of private real final sales growth. And so when I look at the economy was still resilient in April at the bare minimum. And now we think it's going to get less resilient over time, but at the bare minimum, it was resilient in April. That is unusual when you factor in the fact that inflation slowed sharply on a broad-based measure, like kind of like in a recession-type format. In fact, every measure of inflation decelerated in sequential terms, many to below trend type levels, with the exception of median CPI. And so without going there, I went there without actually going there and said, hey, if your goal is to bludgeon the Fed over the head and force them to lower interest rates, one way to do this with more tact is to cook the inflation books, essentially. I think it's too early to accuse the Trump administration of cooking the inflation books, but it was unusual to see such a broad-based deceleration in inflation across many categories to this below trend levels in some respects. I mean, super core CPI at 0.8% on 3-month annualized basis. I mean, where is this coming from? You know, we haven't seen a significant pullback in the economy. And so your framework, where there may be some pressure applied by the administration to force companies to lower price and suffer profit margin erosion, is a very valid framework in the context of that data. So I appreciate you sharing that.
Oh, you're very welcome. As I said, it's a hypothesis, and it's the kind of methodology that I use because I, again, I'm not a stock picker, right? So I'm just looking at it from a bigger picture perspective. Mm. And I do agree that inflation book cooking is something that absolutely I would expect.
Certain the Biden administration was doing it too.
Oh, there you go. Exactly. It's all the hills. Every administration does it with what they call like a hedonic regression. There are all manners of playing with things. So, you know, I'm a real cynic on that front. But the point being, once you start running an economy in terms of statecraft, which is it's me versus that country over there or those countries over there, and it's literally like you're playing a board game or a game of Risk, you know, or some computer game where you're trying to control the world. And I put it to you, that is how the world is being played right now. You don't just sit back and say, oh, yeah, those guys are making a great profit. Fantastic. You want them to be making a great profit if it's producing mass volume at low margin.
Yeah.
Because then you're physically producing more, which is what the neo-mercantilists want. And you make 1 cent per widget. Great. Make a lot of widgets.
Yeah.
The cents can come rolling in. Don't make very few widgets and have a very high return on that, on each one, because then the country as a whole is worse off if they need that widget. And no one is going to go to war or prepare for war, which is, you know, happening in the background generally, as I'm sure we're all aware, and that's physically happening in some countries already, saying, our armed force is really held together with toothpaste and string and chewing gum, but corporate profits are through the roof and house prices are really high. It's like that is not going to float any boats, either morally, in terms of morale, or in terms of logistics. It's not going to work. So if that ideological shift has happened, and again, people can make up their own mind if it has or it hasn't, if the game's being played differently, the results are going to be different than what we're used to.
100%. And speaking of results being very different, that's a perfect segue to transition to another big topic of ours and ours as well. It's just this capital account dynamic. I think the broader financial media has been hyper-focused on the current account and obviously tariffs and they're going to directly impact the current account. But to me, the trade war is always about capital. It's a capital war. They're two sides of the same coin and one side of the coin is bigger, in my opinion. And so if you're talking about moving to a world where the US, which has these structurally high profit margins, and we're moving to a world that may potentially feature structurally lower profit margins, maybe not low, but lower, then we got to have a serious conversation, not you and I, but the world needs to have a serious conversation about the US's net international investment position. There is a gross overweight in US assets that does not make sense in the context of two things. One, this profit margin equation, and two, where we're likely headed from a fiscal policy perspective in the context of a world full of statecraft.
Completely. I mean, let's put the same thing another way, if I may. It's just the same thought, but in slightly different terminology. What does the US really export to the world right now? Obviously, LNG, some military stuff, you know, Boeing, et cetera, food. But in reality, the way the global system as a whole works, and it's not always evident to people inside America, but it's evident to everyone outside it when we look in, if we choose to, and most don't. The US exports financial assets.
Yep, 100%.
So it's US treasuries and US stocks. Because if you run that large trade deficit, you know, you have to bridge that with capital, right? Yeah. And so you're exporting that debt of different forms or ownership of US corporations as an asset, effectively. Now, that is the antithesis of a neo-mercantilist position. Yeah, I could talk for an hour quoting all the different neo-mercantilists from different parts of the world over the last 150 years, all saying this is the road to perdition.
Yep.
This is how you ruin yourself. You know, and that's not just a pure monetarist or Austrian perspective, although there's an overlap with it. It's more just the recognition that your power base just erodes bit by bit by bit. You're giving up ownership or you're indebting yourself for a lifestyle that you can't maintain in the longer term. Even for the US, which of course is a unique case because of the dollar's role internationally. But if you're going to start thinking like a neo-mercantilist, again, it's where's the stuff? Excuse the joke, where's the beef? You know, physically, where is the physical product that we start exporting with blue or white collar employment on the back of it, rather than exporting a financial asset with Wall Street employment on the back of it? And this has to be how it goes. Now, I'm not saying it will. I have to keep repeating that because I don't have a crystal ball. But that if that's what's going to be done, that is what must happen as part of it. And it's why, again, most of the economists you hear writing about this, and particularly the Wall Street economists, would rather chew broken glass than admit this is happening, because you're literally talking about them no longer being needed in the way they are.
Yeah. 100 million billion percent. I mean, and look, I love listening to the Bloomberg surveillances, the Tom Keens of the world, but you can tell there is a real fierce resistance to this, and it's deep rooted, and it's not necessarily just because I think the people in academia and white collar finance generally don't like the way President Trump behaves. I think it's fundamentally you are making us less relevant. It feels that way, certainly when I listen to these programs. And so CNBC just as guilty as well. So I would definitely say I agree with your general take in the sense that our white collar financiers need to wake up and realize that if this is where the world's headed, it may not be, but if this is where the world's headed, we have to get on board with this as opposed to, fight it kicking and screaming. And one thing I'll say in terms of where we're actually all headed with this, to me, one of the key vulnerabilities in the world, and I emphasize vulnerability and not trigger. I think a lot of people talk about our twin deficit situation and how wide it is from the perspective of this is a big problem, or we have a lot of indebtedness, so this is a big problem, therefore. And in my opinion, and I'm sure you agree with this, it's actually not a problem until there's a trigger. It can persist these types of conditions. Our 7% non-war, non-recession budget deficit as a percent of GDP, our 4% current account deficit as a percent of GDP, our 11% twin deficit. These types of conditions can persist indefinitely. They change. That what causes them to change and what causes crises, or particularly balance payments crises, is when some fundamental condition in the economy changes. And right now, shifting from a world where, we are pro-Wall Street to a world where we're neo-mercantilist in theory, pro-Main Street, that could cause a sharp correction in these types of imbalances. And a sharp correction in these types of imbalances may well be great for Main Street, but it could be very painful for Wall Street. And I think that's kind of where we were headed in the first part of April. We have a belief that the bond market backed them off of that transition. But it sounds like from what I'm gathering from our conversation, the transition may just have been delayed as opposed to completely reversed.
I think so. Let me just add a few points, if I may.
Sure, please. Yeah.
So the first one is I completely agree about the sustainability until it isn't sustainable and the trigger. I completely agree that when you have a White House openly saying not just publicly, but via technical papers, and I'm sure you know which papers I'm referring to, both pre-election and after the election, that we want to restructure the global financial system and do the kind of things I'm talking about, and then they actually start doing it, that like a very delayed reaction, there's an absolute pearl-clutching exercise, quite rightly, by the market saying, you're deliberately trying to destroy this system that we've put all our capital in. Sell now, sell the dollar and get out and go somewhere else. Now, a whole separate question maybe in a moment is where do you go, what do you do, right? But I think the Trump administration did underappreciate saying to everybody, this is unsustainable, it can't go on, how much panic there would be from everyone saying, well, okay, we agree, you're right, let's work with you on this, rather than I will fight you to the last breath in my body to prevent you doing it, which is what they're doing instead.
Yep.
The only qualifier I would add is that it is possible that it was the bond market that was the trigger. But my own view is slightly different. I don't think at the level of yield we had at that point, they were unduly worried. I know the directionality wasn't good. I know the volatility was huge. But I don't think the nominal level in itself was worrying them that much, either when it was going higher or when it was really plummeting, everyone saying there's a recession coming. I think that itself was a, mortgages get cheaper argument from their point of view. What I think really, really got them moving, and this is an area I've looked at, not as a professional, but as someone who interacts with some of the best guys in the business, albeit, via X. I don't have them on speed dial or anything. But has looked at this much more than most people, with one or two very honorable exceptions in the market, do. It was the physical supply side. So when you actually started to look at the stories that have been flooding around recently, like there are no Chinese ships coming to US harbors, which was an exaggeration. It wasn't that bad. But a 35% drop, which is what it had been given the inventory cycle in the US and given when everyone needed to stock up ready for all the holidays coming up in the US, because guess what? When you swipe right, goods don't appear automatically. Someone has to make the stuff, put it to a port and then a ship, get it to an American port and then get it into a store, right? It takes time to do this. There was going to be a brick wall hit like in the next 6 weeks, 4 weeks or 6 weeks, where you would go to a store and there wouldn't be stuff that you wanted. There were going to be some blank shelves and or there was going to have to be rationing by price in some things. So that's why we've had the pivot to this 90-day pause on tariffs, which I think we'll probably end up talking about in a moment, I'm guessing. But I think, again, it was the physical economy. And ironically, from a neo-mercantilist perspective, because China is the neo-mercantilist par excellence in that they can turn off the taps and everyone else doesn't get stuff, at which point then everyone else's voters start saying, where's my stuff? I want my stuff. Give me my stuff. They made the point that, yeah, this US pivot is necessary to prevent that power being in China. But at least for now, they had to say, okay, let's start talking. People could restock so that you have stuff for Thanksgiving and, you know, and the holidays later in the year.
Fair, fair. That's a great, I love that. I hadn't considered the physical supply side part of the equation. And I certainly, I think it's correct. I think you are, you're certainly onto something in that regard. So thank you for sharing that. I would add one additional thing. I think part of the reason why the bond market may have played a key role here was not just the actual volatility and the very clear capital outflow dynamic that we were witnessing. It was the fact that they were doing things that were causing growth to slow, yet the bond market didn't respond with lower yields. I think if they had their way, they would still very well be on this hard, heavy-handed policy prescription to force neo-mercantilism if bond yields were going down, because that's what they want. They've already told us this on several occasions earlier in the administration that they want lower bond yields, they want lower mortgage rates, and they ultimately want to facilitate the a resurgence in bank lending, particularly among small and regional banks. And so the fact that the bond market didn't cooperate, they essentially, in my opinion, had to go back to the drawing board. It's like, well, we thought we can blow up the economy and get bond yields down and maybe, you know, force a bunch of trade deals. We blew up the economy, bond yields went up. Now let's back off. and obviously the supply side of the equation, which I hadn't considered. So thank you for sharing that. I think that was obviously a big factor as well. So either way, it seems like we're in this, you know, period of a minimum detente. At maximum, we were sort of closer to the maximum. So let's we can play we can have a friendly discourse about this. It sounds like maybe I'm overreading to you. It sounds like you may be of the view that the detente will pass and we'll go back to sort of heavy-handed mercantilism, a neo-mercantilism, or we're sort of the view that I think they tried it and didn't realize it's probably not going to work. It's certainly not at that speed. What's your thought there? Am I right in terms of my assumption of what you're saying?
Your assumption is correct. Can I just return just for one moment back to the bond?
Please, yeah, yeah. No, this is fascinating. Yeah, I love this.
There are such great points, but I just want to pick this one up. But I think you're right too. So we're both agreeing with each other, and there are many different answers, you know, in parallel, which are all part of the overall answer. I think what this will raise as a question imminently is one that I was banging on about a few years ago, which sits underneath a key question, which I keep bringing up on every public channel I have like this, which is to ask yourself the question, whatever job you're in, whatever position of authority you're in, what's GDP for? Just take a second, and you can have an hour-long conversation or a 10-second conversation, but it's a very poignant one. And if you don't have an answer, the higher up the food chain you are, the more worried I am about you doing your job, because you should have an answer. Like, what? It's not just because markets. That's not any kind of answer. You know, whatever it is, think about it. So within that, under that question umbrella, you have to start thinking, as a neo-mercantilist, what's GDP for? Okay, more production. Is it more production of haircuts? Is it more production of apps that make your dog look like a cat and vice versa? Or is it more production of bullets, bombs, cars, steel, you know, military stuff or industrial stuff, chemicals, whatever? How are you going to achieve that? Because at the aggregate level in the US, Fed funds is still the benchmark rate for the US and the rest of the world, pretty much. And yeah, you get credit spreads, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't need to get too technical or wonkish. But how are you going to get capital to flow where you think GDP should be for and not to flow to where GDP shouldn't be going, because that's not what GDP is for? How do you manage that within a market mechanism without having a command economy, China style, or semi-command economy? What mechanisms are you going to use? And again, the historical neo-mercantilists, okay, their view was we need soft loans. You need a state development bank or a national bank, as Alexander Hamilton wanted, to make sure you can borrow. Like, okay, you're important, you borrow at 2%. You're not, you borrow at 7%. And differential interest rates.
Oh yeah.
And that's one of the, and that's why I wanted to bring it up before we get onto the trade part, because they're going to have to happen again, looking backwards, look forward. If anyone's read the playbook of past neo-mercantilists, this will have to emerge at some point. What sectors matter? And you're either going to have to give them subsidies, or it's going to have to be subsidized borrowing. Because if you just, for example, if they slash Fed funds, no forecast, let's imagine they do. You know, Trump would like that. Let's say 200 basis points off Fed funds over the next couple of months. What would happen? You and I and others would immediately have conversations. Which stocks are going to go through the roof? How much a house price is going to start moving higher? And I would say to you, is that what GDP is for?
Yeah.
What have you achieved with that? Nothing. And what did we achieve after the GFC, the global financial crisis, when we cut interest rates to zero or negative? Absolutely nothing to the power of three. Nothing. Well, and yet we could have rebuilt all our infrastructure. We could have changed the whole structure. Clearly. We could have done everything. We just, and I nearly use rude language, but we just threw it away up the wall. That's absolutely what we did.
Well, we capitalized the Mag 7. That's what we did with it.
Just mad stuff. Mad stuff. So now we have so much debt that we're actually talking about systemic change. If we have to go that route again, it's going to have to be radical architectural shifts, which I think, again, are maybe at the extreme part of what we'll see. But we can't just go that route, either in the US or anywhere else, without thinking about how we're going to get money to the key things. And in Europe, for example, it's going to be defense. They want to spend 5% of GDP on defense, and they spend 1.5% now. Where is that money going to come from when you're already running a 5 or 6% fiscal deficit? And you've got 120% debt to GDP in some countries. How are you going to do this? And you can't cut other spending. You're going to have mechanisms coming in and a more nuanced conversation than just rates go down, rates go up. Whose rates?
Yeah.
How? So that's the first point I wanted to raise. I'll let you continue before we then move on to the
tariff. No. I'm listening to you. This is outstanding. Keep going.
Okay. So then I'm presuming... And again, this is all based on past reading of other neo-mercantilists. It's like, this is what frustrates me. So many financial media now will start using the term. You will see mercantilists thrown about more often. Ask them to define it. They can't. Ask them to name one. They can't. Ask them to name anywhere where it worked. They can't. Actually, it's worked incredibly well. China, Japan, South Korea, Germany, pre-World War One. It's a bit of America up until World War Two. It's a very effective policy if you can get away with it. So anyway, let's go back to the tariffs part. China is not going to give up neo-mercantilism. Yeah. It's worked for it incredibly. Where was China 30 years ago? Where was China 40 years ago? Totally. Flat on its back. Now, people will say it was market forces. Yes, inside a neo-mercantilist framework.
Yeah.
It's basically like a water wheel where you channel the power of the water to get hydropower. That's what neo-mercantilism is. You don't just say, oh, it'll flood, it won't flood, the water will go where it wants. You channel the water to get what you want. You flood others and you have drought in other places so you get what you need. Yeah. They're not going to give that up. That's the central mechanism of political ideology.
Total.
And it's an ideological issue. And the US has been free trade right the way up until Trump won. Now, you know, okay, but under Reagan, you had the Plaza Accord and you had voluntary export restraint against Japanese exporters of autos to the US, which worked, by the way. They started to invest in the US instead, right? Again, mercantilism works.
Yeah.
But now, overtly, the shift is back towards neo-mercantilism. The US can't give that up. So explain to me, and I'm not saying to you personally, I'm speaking to the market as a whole, where is this detente actually going to lead if fundamentally both of countries have a clashing set of overlapping policies? Unless the US says, okay, we're going to be in the Amacanta list here, 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 and here, but we'll buy socks from you and toothbrushes. China doesn't want to make socks and toothbrushes. They've moved up the value chain.
Yeah.
They're selling cars and good ones. They want to make planes next.
So I don't even know if this is my answer, but my initial gut response to your question was they have to break up. I mean, it's like they got to both start seeing other people.
Yeah, you know? Well, exactly. So then let's pivot back to what you said about, are we doing it a quickie divorce? I think the US thought they could get a quickie divorce and they could get away with the house and the car and the dog.
Totally.
That's what I think was happening. Instead, they found out they've got one of those Rottweiler lawyers on the other side, and they're gonna really get taken to the cleaners. So now let's really itemize who owns what, you know, who's got all the CD collection, who's got the silverware, etc. You know, let's just go through and carefully itemize everything while you're strategizing with your lawyer for how much dirt you can find on the other partner. Totally. To try and make sure that when you eventually get into the court, you know, who's the judge? You know, let's find out if we can do something nice for the judge's daughter. That never happens in the US, right? And this is the game I believe is being played out. Now, it's not a forecast. Again, I don't set forecasts for China or the US. I want to make that abundantly clear. But from a helicopter view, history, ideology, big picture framework, I can't see how, other than saying, because markets, as in it's good for Wall Street, you can say anything other than what you just concluded, which is there's going to be a breakup. The question is just when and how.
Yeah, no, totally. That's this is fascinating. I think I've started to realize where this is all headed. And so I love your divorce framework, because Wall Street, at the bare minimum, Wall Street is at nothing resilient. They'll find a way to make money somehow. And so Wall Street can make money in a lengthy, drawn out divorce process. Wall Street will struggle to make money and will probably lose lots of money if they try to have this quick and dirty, messy divorce, because that creates a whole, it just creates a new distribution of outcomes that the current level of capital or the current capital stock is not positioned for. And so the slower that transition is, the more Wall Street can move capital and allocate capital more effectively and efficiently to generate return. And so that kind of leads me to like a kind of a trap. I don't want to say trap door in all this, but where does the role, in your opinion, of US fiscal policy in all this? Because to me, it sounds like if you want to have a divorce at all and you want to run mercantilist policies at all, a necessary precondition for the success of that transition and those policies, in my opinion, is fiscal austerity. You cannot keep coming to the world with a 7% budget deficit to GDP that needs to be capitalized. You can't continue having a 4% current account deficit to GDP that needs to be capitalized if you want to have a breakup with one of the world's largest creditor nations. I want to say it's the second largest creditor nation in the world, at over $3 trillion in terms of their net international investment surplus. So, what's your take on all this? Because it doesn't strike me, and based on our analysis, that we're moving in the right direction from a fiscal austerity perspective to make this successful. So what does this look like? What does this process look like from your perspective with that condition?
Okay, so I've got a couple of things to say here, and hopefully they'll entertain you. Again, start getting into the area of statecraft, economic statecraft, and neo-mercantilism. You have to start doing things in a very, very unorthodox way. Things don't work the way that economic policy thinks they should. Your analysis is absolutely correct that you cannot keep running the kind of fiscal deficits you're running in the US now. And definitely things will have to change. The question is how they change. Let me just segue for a second, make an example, and then come back to what I think is going to happen in the US. Do you happen to know, and it's a bit of an unfair question, but I'm putting you on the spot if you don't mind, what do you think the approximate, and I'll take an approximate figure because I'm giving an approximate figure back, I may be a little bit out of date, but approximately what do you think the IMF estimate is of what China's actual fiscal deficit is?
Actual?
Yeah, actual. Not what they give as the headline figure, but when you start including local government, state banks, and you know all kinds of tricks they play off book, what do you think China's fiscal deficit is? If you were going to be a very conservative accountant and say, no, that's government debt, that's government debt, that's government debt. Have a little guess.
Fiscal deficit, probably somewhere in the 8 to 10% range.
Yeah, you're not far off. It's unclear, but it's actually been as high as 12 or 14.
Wow.
in recent years, and I think it will probably be back in that range again fairly soon.
Yeah.
So I'm illustrating that you've got an economy there which is still a net creditor to the world, running a huge trade surplus, and it's running a fiscal deficit the size of which would blow up any other economy.
Yeah.
How do you do it? You put some of it in state banks. You put some of it in local governments. You put some of it off book. You do lots of different tricks. So does the US need to tighten its fiscal deficit or reduce the fiscal deficit? It does. You and Doge, in terms of trying to say where can we cut down on corruption and waste, is not a bad idea. And I think it's a good political idea to try to sell to people right the way until it's them losing their job and then they're against it, right? But you can understand what they're doing there. It's also a very good way of showing MAGA voters, we have cleaned the stables, if you then need to fill them full of manure again in the future. Because, yeah. We cleaned them. So it's political messaging too, I think, in advance. But the US is going to have to get much more credit going into the system. So first of all, Wall Street will have a lot to do funding projects, but in the real capital stock. So instead of making money from actually lending into the physical economy, building factories again. You've heard Bessent already say he thinks community banks need to step up. I think they're going to try and use that method instead, because actually, if you look at your community bank, they know the credit viability in the local area. They know who could really get things growing with a loan. So maybe you'll start getting federal government support or just regulatory easing to get more credit coming through that particular channel. Again, neo-mercantilists in the past have argued for that, or for state investment banks, which China uses too. I don't think the US is going to go that route. I can't imagine Trump having a big state organization doing it, but I think the regulatory forbearance might work there. And then we're going to get one other method, and I'm going to have to use some slightly colorful language here. I hope you won't mind. Where I think you're going to get something creative. It's what I call fartcraft. Because we live in a world of financial flatulence. When we're talking about a financialized economy, it really is just flatulence. There's nothing behind it, effectively. There's no physical product. And obviously, it smells nicer for some people because that's where they make their money, literally. But no one who's a neo-mercantilist would look at a financialized economy and say, this is what we want. In an age in which we live in a world of Warcraft, which is very, very evident right way around us, how do you get a financialized economy ready for Warcraft? And you have to do it via fartcraft in the US case, because you can't go the hard route. And the parallel I draw here, Norway is a country which has gas and oil. They take that physical product, which you can use for lots of things. You refine the oil, you've got a physical product there. They sell it, they get the money back, and they buy financial assets so they can retire. US treasuries, US stocks, European stocks, etc. That's how economic policy works if you start from the physical economy. If you start from a financialized economy, what you might have to do is start a sovereign wealth fund, which I believe has just happened. And you'll say, but how can you have a sovereign wealth fund? The government deficit is huge. So there's no savings, there's no money in your pocket. And the current account deficit is huge. There's no national savings. Where is this money coming from? So instead you say, right, here's $6 billion worth of land in Dakota, which is now monetized because we've collateralized it. We go to Wall Street with a gun to the head and say, take one for the team, leverage that up 10 times, please, as part of economic statecraft. Then you go to Greenland and you give everyone $1 million.
Yeah.
And you just bought yourself Greenland, which I can assure you has got real physical assets, minerals, rare earths, etc., worth more than $60 billion.
Right.
And a location in which you can monetize as a revenue stream to pay the whole thing back. Have you started with any physical asset? No, apart from a piece of land which you weren't using anyway. But you use financial fartcraft to get yourself ready for Warcraft. And you've done that effectively expanding the fiscal deficit off book China style.
Yeah, this is there's a way. So that I'm more optimistic on the destination than I've been having had this conversation, because it sounds like there are levers they can pull that just have yet to be revealed. Now, I think maybe potentially giving them too much credit and saying that they are going to pull these levers, because very clearly you've really thoughtful about all this and you've been thinking about this for a really long time. But unfortunately, Michael, you don't work in the administration. We'd love to have you. I think we need more Michael Everys and less Alex. that's neither here nor there. But I agree with a lot of what you said. I mean, Colin, if you throw the slide up, like we're already seeing the deregulation push impact bank lending. I mean, bank lending was trending below trend for years, for the past couple of years, because we've had this significant crowding out, as you well know, the size of the deficits, the level of interest rates is crowding out the traditional bank lending channel, which by and large, you know, speaks to small and medium-sized enterprises. The large companies can obviously capitalize themselves in the capital markets. And, you know, capital markets, I want to say, if you look at private non-financial sector debt in the U.S., 70% of it comes from the capital markets. I mean, we have this massively hyper-financialized economy, to your point. But if you look over the past few weeks, really over the past month or so, we've had a significant acceleration in commercial bank loans and leases. We're now up at 7.1% in aggregate on a three-month annualized basis. That number's finally above trend for the first time since early 2023. And it's largely coming from the large banks. We know Scott Bessent has explicitly communicated that he wants small banks to get their, to start lending again. So we know that deregulation is going to come with a massive capital D in the coming months, and we're going to be able to view it through these channels in terms of bank lending. So 100% agree with you there that that's coming. And in our opinion, this is one of the most underappreciated upside risks in financial markets, in my opinion, is that we're going to see a real true credit cycle, because we haven't. I mean, you go back to, if you look at, what slide is that? One of my favorite slides, slide 29. If you look at kind of this entire business, so we've been in this unusual business cycle where really since the GFC, the private non-financial sector debt to GDP ratio has been declining since the GFC. All of the leverage, that means GDP has been growing faster than credit. So the levering up in the economy has come exclusively from the public sector since the GFC. Now, part of this is Dodd-Frank and Basel III regulating the banks and forcing them to take less risk. But a lot of it was just the fact that we were crowding out the private sector. And so I think the uncrowding out of the private sector can come from one of two ways. One, deregulation, but two, getting interest rates down through fiscal austerity. In our view, and this is a loaded question that we don't have time to unpack, in our view, we're not moving in a big enough direction for fiscal austerity to really supercharge this process. But you know, the stuff that they're doing with tariffs and with DOGE is at the margins in the right direction relative to where we were, you know, kind of the handoff from President Biden. So this is a lot. I'm so glad we had you on the program, man, because you opened my eyes personally. I know you're going to open a lot of our clients' eyes to some of these both upside risks and downside risks. But I think I'm walking away from this, and correct me if you don't agree with me, but I'm a little bit more sanguine on this transition to neo-mercantilism than I probably was. And I think I'm as sanguine as anybody about it, because we think that we're going to paradigm C, which is a combination of neo-mercantilism with all the fiscal and monetary largesse from the prior regime, which in my opinion, I'm like, that sounds so bullish. It's, you know, it's like, let's just get every line up, charts, stocks, markets, GDP, GDI, everything is going to go up in paradigm C, in our view. So you're making me realize that there are more levers that the administration can pull to facilitate that outcome. So thank you for that.
Hi, look, you're very welcome. And to be abundantly clear, that is a realistic outcome. It doesn't mean it will happen. As I said at the beginning, it can go horribly wrong this way, it can go horribly wrong that way, and the other side get to have a say. This is, you know, this is a game of chess. You're not playing it with yourself. But everything you're saying there, particularly about the credit cycle, I think is incredibly important. Incredibly important, because you don't just want the private sector credit cycle. It needs to be a private sector credit cycle exceeding whatever the government is doing on the austerity side. And here's where it all links in, because you obviously like looking at balance sheets. But if you're going to do that, you will have to have a reduction in the trade deficit. Yeah. You have to, the way the balance sheets link up. So it can only be achieved via a neo-mercantilist reduction. And most economists don't understand how those balance sheets intersect and how one reflects another, and they must logically be the same. I mean, the simple way of describing it for people who maybe don't look at that professionally is, if you've got a private sector deficit of 2% of GDP, hypothetically, and a government deficit of 5% of GDP, well, your current account will be 7, because it's got to be the cumulative public plus private position. So if you're going to start putting more borrowing into the private sector, The government sector can reduce, but you know, you need to have even more juice coming through there in the private sector to compensate for that pain from the government tightening its belt. And that will itself also at the same time see the trade deficit narrow. It has to.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah, and that's assuming that there's enough pullback. I mean, I think there's a world in which the U.S. current account balance deficit gets wider if they don't pull back enough fiscally and step on the gas from a financial deregulation standpoint and get a private sector credit cycle going. Oh, and imagine you've got a private sector credit cycle going and you still have $2 trillion budget deficits.
Well, completely. And again, maybe I didn't speak with complete clarity just a moment ago, because if the private sector is going to be borrowing more, it needs to be generating productive growth with that.
Oh, yes.
If people are just going to borrow and spend, that trade deficit is going to blow out immediately. You need to be generating real growth from it and real physical assets, which again is what is GDP for. What kind of things is that private sector borrowing for? And it can't just be for consumption. It's got to be for investment, which is going to grow the economy. And then you can do it with a reduced trade deficit. But if it's just for consumption, then it's even harder.
Michael, this is one of my favorite conversations I've had. I think we've probably done 40 or 50 of these since we started the firm. Definitely a top two conversation I've had thus far, man. Kudos to you. You have a brilliant framework, brilliant mind. I would love to have you back on the program in the future. Before we wrap up, I have two things for you. One is where do we send people to go find you? And then another one's a very loaded question that will automatically make our audience want to have you back. But the first one is, where do we send people to go to find you?
Sure. Well, let me give you a few answers. First of all, Rabobank Knowledge, if you Google that, our work is there. That's mainly for corporate clients, but please do have a look as a starting base. I am on LinkedIn. I don't do a great deal there, but I am on LinkedIn. And I do have conversations and chats about all these kind of topics on X. And my handle is at the Michael Every, all one word.
Yep. Excellent. Definitely go check him out. I'm super impressed personally with the quality of your work and knowledge, and very clearly you're doing some great work for your clients over at Rabobank. So thank you. Thank you for your time. I'm going to leave you with a detonating bomb of a question, but and you don't have to spend too much time unpacking because I know we're at the hour here, but just, you know, what are your high level thoughts on, you know, we have a belief that we're in this fourth turning. Are you familiar with the fourth turning framework?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, we have a belief that that's one of our core fundamental beliefs, and you know, this political dissension is not just happening domestically but globally, and we're all sharpening our elbows and kind of sharpening our knives and spears in preparation for war. And it may be the case that President Trump, who I know for a fact through a former colleague, Neil Howes, the author of the fourth turning thesis, he knows for a fact that Steve Bannon pulled Trump aside and said, hey, read this, run for president, back in 2014 or 2015. And so it could be the case that President Trump is so concerned about this path that we're on from a total war conflict perspective that he's willing to do neo-mercantilism for the sake of, you know, the GDP, for the sake of something at all costs. What's your take on that, and kind of what's your general time frame for, like, how much does he need to get accomplished? Not time frame, but how much do you think he feels like he needs to get accomplished before his term is up, versus how much can he push to, say, J.D. Vance into the future?
Okay, great question. I think he does think like that, by the way, from other sources. Yep. And I think a lot of what he's doing reflects not just the pent up time that he had during the Biden administration to think, what do I want to do, you know, if I win again, but a recognition that the clock is ticking. If you listen to counterparties around the world who are dealing with him at the moment, they can't believe the speed with which America is trying to do everything. And I don't think it's just because you only have, you know, until the midterms, and then after that it's more difficult, or, you know, 3.5 years, et cetera, et cetera. I suspect there is an underlying recognition that, yes, flood the zone, yes, confuse people, et cetera, but also time is absolutely pressing. If you look at where the US versus China relative strength was 3.5 years ago or 4 years ago, and look at where we are today, where do you think we'll be if nothing is done 4 years from now? It's really not that difficult to project forward. Where was the Chinese auto industry 4 years ago?
Yeah.
What industry will they dominate in 4 years from now with the model they have, right? And then what will the U.S. military look like relative to that? in 4 years. And it's pretty terrifying. So I how much achieve? That's why he is in such a hurry, even now having to just slow it down a bit, rip the plaster off more slowly, because of the fact that, you know, there was going to be nothing on US shelves temporarily. He still has to try and get a new Mar-a-Lago Accord framework in place before the midterms, just in case they go south. He has to get other countries signing up, like the UK has signed up. And even what the UK has signed up is very contingent. It's not a legally binding document. It's contingent on people getting things signed up. But if you look at what just happened in the visits to Saudi and Qatar and the UAE, quite remarkable. What's really interesting is that most of the American press, and I'm generalizing because I'm looking from abroad and you're seeing different press than what I am, is just talking about, big dollar signs being flashed about and maybe it doesn't mean anything. And, you know, look at them trying to, you know, kiss the ring and camels in the desert and a mobile McDonald's truck, etc. Not a great deal of analysis of what was actually agreed. And if you look at the European press, they didn't pay any attention at all, other than Trump's in his element with these autocrats. That was basically the European media view. They completely miss the potential scale of what was agreed. Not just the vast deals being done. Defense flows into Saudi, huge. Not just the huge potential sales of Boeing to Qatar. You know, and this is a company that wasn't having a good time with it up until recently. But also collaboration on AI and energy. The likelihood, going back to a point we were making at the beginning, the Saudi will happily keep oil prices at a lower level than they want for themselves right now, as a political favor to Trump, but to make sure that they're within a US bloc going forward. Low oil, cheap energy, lower inflation in the US. What's the quid pro quo? Stronger US bloc. Okay, so basically you're seeing the Middle East, where most of the world's energy is, moving over to the US, and maybe a deal with Iran. Whether it's a can-kicking deal or not, again, that's another conversation. But it's lower oil prices and a new economic architecture there. And then after that, he's going to try and get India in. If he gets India and the Middle East in, and he's already got the UK, Japan, South Korea, Southeast Asia will have to follow. And then effectively, it's only Europe who, they say a camel is a horse designed by a committee. Well, you know, Europe is run by a committee, right? It's only Europe who will then look around and think, okay, which way are we going to go? Yeah. But most of the world, the developed world, has signed up with the US already. And then once you've agreed that, then you start building, then you start getting the lawyers involved, then you start getting the technocrats involved. But you've got to get that done in the next couple of months to keep that momentum moving. Because if you don't and you let the technocrats take over, which is what they always want to do, 20 years from now, we're still talking about it. And the US is here and China is there. So from the US perspective, now.
20 years from now, my background in Mandarin will come in handy.
Yeah.
If we stay on this current path. Michael, this is fantastic, man. I'm so grateful to have you on our show. Safe travels. We'll definitely have you back on if you'll have us. And best of luck, my friend.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to the next one already.
Likewise. Brother, appreciate you. Thank you.
Disclaimer, 42 Macro does not provide, and no portion of our content purports to be, individualized or specific investment advice, and 42 Macro does not provide investment advice to individuals. All information provided by 42 Macro is general in nature and is made without regard to individual levels of sophistication or investment experience, investment preferences, objectives or risk parameters, and without regard to the suitability of the content for individuals or entities who may access it. No information provided by 42 Macro should be construed as an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor should it be construed as tailored or specific to you or consumer thereof. You understand and agree that our content does not constitute specific recommendations of any particular investment, security, portfolio, transaction, or strategy, nor does it recommend any specific course of action is suitable for any specific person or entity or group of persons or entities. At any point in time, the employees of 42 Macro may own a portion of or all the ETF securities discussed in 42 Macro Research content. 42 Macro Research content is based upon information from sources believed to be reliable. 42 Macro is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information, nor is it responsible for the accuracy or authenticity of the information upon which it relies.